change clarifies jury instruction about their choices regarding the issues that Mr. Taylor just raised. The purpose of the bill really is to make clear the manner in which an aggravated murder sentencing proceeding is to be conducted in two instances where the sentence of death is not an option, and those instances are when the prosecution advises the court that the state is not going to push for the sentence of death, and then the other instances where the person who's found guilty of aggravated murder is a juvenile and the sentence of death is prohibited. So as I understand the issue and I'm presenting it to you today, it is simply a clarification in jury instruction regarding jury instruction. Clarify some language that has seemed a bit ambiguous up to this point.
Are there any questions or discussion by the committee about this bill? This bill, as I recall, Representative Wilson had no opposition.
I believe that's correct.
And the people who came forward to testify were Mr. Nass from the Judicial Department, and with him were folks from the Attorney General's office who handled the appeals process, as I recall, and then also with him were was the deputy public defender from the state of Oregon, who also came and testified. They were neutral, technically neutral on the bill, but they had no objection to it, and they would have likely been the party that would have been, you know, would have objected if they thought this was affecting their client's rights in any way. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Ringo.
I would just like to ask one question. I understand this is intended to clarify, but is the current system similar to what's set forth in the bold language here, where 10 or more need to vote to change it from without parole to with parole? Is that how it currently exists?
Yes, as I understand it, and as I believe I understood the testimony in front of the subcommittee, is that is current practice, that is somewhere that's identified as the way that's currently done, but there is some confusion apparently with respect to the instructions, and this it seemed to me, and this is just my sense of what I think was testified to at committee, that it hasn't even been that they've had a significant problem yet. Parties seem to have managed to get together and with the judge have developed what the instruction ought to be, but they recognized it as a point where there is not very much clarification and that it could present a problem if parties weren't willing to all work together in the instruction drafting with the judge.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other comments? Okay. Representative Wilson?
Yes, I would move House Bill 2340 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Wilson has moved House Bill 2340 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll.
Representative
Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Cheddarly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bowman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chairman Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2340 moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. I'm going to, as I said before, my sense is unless we really feel strongly as a committee that it ought to go on the consent calendar, I'm going to resist putting stuff on the consent calendar. Because this one addresses, again, the issue of aggravated murder and sentencing, there is a possibility that people will want to be able to ask questions about this bill based on our conversation on the floor earlier this week. So I'm going to recommend that we move this bill with a carrier. And I'd like to stick with you, Representative Wilson, since
yep.
You've carried so far. Is that okay?
That would be fine.
Okay, great. Representative Wilson is assigned as the carrier. Okay, we are now shifting to House Bill 2364, and we'll open a work session on that bill. And with us is our acting counsel, Marilee Harrell. Thanks for being here today. If you want to go ahead and give us just a brief introduction to the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2364 carried by Representative Shetterly, permits Medicaid payment of costs and fees associated with guardianship where the guardianship is necessary to authorize needed medical treatment for long-term care recipients. It allows payment to be made either out of Medicaid funds or by allowing the recipient to deduct payment for such expenses before determining his or her contribution toward the cost of such care.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a bill that comes to you from the civil with a referral from the motion to pass and refer to Ways and Means. It has fiscal impact. The reason for that fiscal impact is that the effect of this bill is to allow low-income, medically needy people who are receiving Medicaid assistance to retain an increased portion of their monthly income to pay for guardianship expenses and legal expenses related to a guardianship. The purpose of this is designed to make it more possible for low-income people who are medically needy to obtain a guardianship, which is difficult to do at this point under current law, where they are not allowed to retain sufficient income to pay for the expenses of a guardianship, the thinking being that to enable a private guardian or even in some cases a public guardian to provide care for people will actually reduce long-term expenses and avoid the necessity ultimately of a commitment to state care and custody. But because this does increase the amount that Medicaid recipients would be entitled to retain, it has a fiscal impact because that means more money would be spent on those Medicaid clients. And so we're recommending the policy is good. We send it down to Ways and Means to see if they can find a way to pay for it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you. I don't have a fiscal in my file. Does anyone else?
Colleagues, I was last night given a revision fiscal, and this is the one that is the form that is filled out by the division. I don't have the actual fiscal coming out of the fiscal office, but this was the form filled out by the division. And with the dash two amendments, which were viewed as a broadening, the 01-03 fiscal on this bill appears to be $1,857,000. So it's a pretty substantial fiscal. I chatted briefly with the folks from SDSD yesterday about this issue and asked them whether or not they had ideas that would address some of the policy issues that the committee talked about and that the bill addresses, but that would do so potentially with less of a fiscal impact. And that was a conversation we had late yesterday afternoon, and they did actually, in fact, this morning, give me a list of possible issues that might help address this issue, but do it in a way that didn't have the same level of fiscal impact. So I guess I'm open, and I'll defer to you, Representative Shetterly, since you're the carrier of the bill, as to what you think this committee ought to do.
Well, I don't know. I only have the information we had at the hearing. I don't know what they've come in with since the hearing.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about the hearing? I wasn't able to tune into that one.
Well, it was very cordial.
Nice. Yeah. What were people wearing?
I'm trying to remember. We had about five or six elder law bills up that morning. It seems to me that the issue was the fiscal. I think the policy was not so much the issue, but the cost. And I think the sense of the subcommittee was that, being the policy committee, we were satisfied that it was a good policy. Obviously, the fiscal impact was something that Ways and Means would have to deal with when it got down there. The fiscal we had at the time, I think, showed a cost of about $696,000 for the current or for the 2001-03. Biennium. SDSD, I think the proponents for the bill thought that the fiscal might be less than that, but again, that's a battle that, my experience suggests, better fought in Ways and Means than in a policy committee. They were disagreeing with that fiscal impact statement. I've not seen anything more current than that.
Yes, Representative Ringo.
I have some scribbled notes here that references their specific disagreement on the fiscal impact. The folks in the state bar were contemplating that the number of people that might use this would be about, it would go from about 50 to 100 or so, whereas the folks from SDS thought it would be as high as 500. So that's a tenfold disagreement as to how many would be using it, and that's really what has to be resolved in terms of analyzing the fiscal impact.
And was it obviously the committee referred the bill up because they agreed with the policy decision, but did you have any sense of, I think SDSD went through, at least in my conversation with them, a reasonable method of anticipating how they got to the number of people they thought might avail themselves of this. I think one of their concerns is that when a program like this becomes available, people who are on sort of the edges of the program tend to move themselves into the situation where they can access the program, and I think they're worried about that. I guess my personal sense is, and I'm happy to, on this one, sort of take counsel from all the committee members, my personal sense is that if we think there's a good policy issue here, but that we know that it's DOA with $1.8 million fiscal, the idea would be to consider whether or not there are some other things we could do in working with the elder law section and SDSD to try to narrow the fiscal as much as possible and still try to achieve some of the policy. And I'm afraid if we just commit this bill today to the black hole of Ways and Means, we will have been making a great, wonderful policy statement, but we will have done nothing else.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Lowe and then Representative Walker.
Oh, I defer to our chair of that subcommittee, and then I'll make a comment.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Lowe. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The committee the other day, the objections they had in regards to the fiscal statement, which I do not have the updated information you have on the fiscal. So
I've asked Andrea to copy that. She'll be getting copies out.
So I can't comment on that. But the last paragraph of the fiscal statement that we had, they were taking issue with the fact that there was a presumption that the state has the same ratio of clients to guardians, and they had just, carried that data forward to determine what the estimated cost would be. I think they were questioning whether that would actually be true as to whether the population was dispersed in such a way or the needs were the same in every county or every district of the state. There's really no way to know that because apparently they don't have enough data to determine how many people in some of the other parts of the state would actually request guardian services.
Well, Jane Ellen Widens is here from SDSD, and why don't you two come forward and let the committee have a crack at asking you some questions about how you calculated your numbers.
Thank you. While she's coming forward. My recollection on this case was that people are going without protection. People are going forward without protection because they can't pay the filing fees or get an attorney to assist them, and it leaves our elder citizens in dire shape without some sort of protection. A lot of the lawyers who do this, lawyers from this particular section of the bar, I've practiced in this area too, do it for free or for very low cost, but you can't front the filing fees, and it's a very difficult situation. The other point that was brought up is that we're talking about Medicaid funds. Those funds belong to the recipient. They don't belong to the state, and what the state is quibbling about is whether or not they get a piece of that money to help reimburse them for the costs of their care. That money belongs to the recipient. And that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, well, with that, Jane Ellen.
go ahead.
why don't you first walk us through, again, how you calculated, and I recognize that the new fiscal is based on the adoption by the subcommittee of the -2 amendments. So why don't you walk us through how you got there?
Sure. My name is Jane Ellen Whitehance, and I'm the Legislative Coordinator for Senior and Disabled Services Division, Chairman Williams and members of the committee. we're sorry that you didn't get the fiscal, the revised fiscal in time, and I'll try to find out if that was on our side or on LFO, and make sure that we correct that on our side. What we did was, in initiating a fiscal on this, was try to determine what would be the most logical course and how we could figure out the numbers. And what we did was we took the public guardianship numbers in Multnomah County, one of two counties that have a public guardianship program, figured out what percentage of those numbers in the public guardianship program made up of a ratio of how many of those were also of their total Medicaid clients. And from that, we extrapolated to the rest of the state based on our Medicaid clients. So it was basically a statistic or a ratio based on Multnomah County and then used as the rest of our clients throughout the state. Currently, and I think why the state bar and the elder law section disagrees with those numbers, and we currently only pay for about 50 of those. And the reason we do that is we have a very, very tightly controlled process within SDSD Central Office where we only select certain cases to do this, where there is no other options, where people come to us with extreme needs. So the number that we have done is only about 50 a year. This bill would not allow us to have any kind of control over that. It would be anyone who meets the criteria would be eligible for it. So we do think that the fiscal and the number is much larger than the traditional 50 a year that we have been using. And just to explain kind of the mechanisms and why this impacts SDSD's budget, and to make it as simple as possible, because I even get confused a little bit on it, basically what happens is we allow the individuals who are our clients to keep a portion of their money that they then help pay for their room and board and a portion of their costs. And what happens is if we take that money away and tell them that they have to use it for another purpose, such as a guardianship fee, the Senior and Disabled Services Division has to then make up that difference and pay the room and board fee or other cost of care that comes about. So we would end up spending money because we've diverted the funds that the clients are already sharing in the program.
If I may interject, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, one point that I do want to make on that. I'm sorry?
Your name?
Oh, I'm sorry, excuse me. Rick Mills, Senior and Disabled Services Division. One point on those numbers that we extrapolated from the Multnomah County Public Guardian is we need to note that number is based just upon people who are with the Multnomah Public Guardian. That figure does not include how many people are in Multnomah County who have private guardians, whether it be a family member, a relative, or a paid professional guardian. So that percentage ratio of 0.6% is strictly based upon those people of ours that are part of the public guardian program and does not include those people in Multnomah County who are Medicaid clients who have private guardians. We don't know how many of those people are out there. And so for that reason, I think it's important for us to understand that initial ratio by its very nature is inherently low, because it totally excludes an entire population where we have private guardians and we have no particular knowledge of those individuals. And so I wanted to emphasize that point. Now, whether the ratio that we developed in Multnomah County will hold true throughout the rest of the state, you know, to be quite honest, I have no statistics to tell you that it's definitely going to hold or that it won't hold.
First Representative Krieger, then Representative Lowe.
Chair Williams, on this thing on Multnomah County, can you go back on that page down to Section 2? Am I reading something wrong there? About 35% of 86,000 is 181? Is there something?
I'm sorry, I don't have the figures in front of me.
What you're talking about, Representative Krieger, is the revised fiscal in front of you now?
That you prepared.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can explain that, Representative Williams and members of the committee. What happened in the -2 amendments that were passed out of committee?
Oh, okay.
A piece of the legislation changed where The original bill excluded people receiving Social Security supplemental income. And that provision was reduced. And if someone is receiving supplemental security income, we are required to allow them to keep that income. So any additional fees or programs that we require them to participate in or to pay for, we end up making up all of that cost, and we cannot do a cost share on that. And that's where that 35% came from. 35% of the clients would be SSI only, and we would have to do total general funds on that program.
Follow up.
It says of 86,000 is the number.
Correct.
And 35% of those.
Mr. Kerr.
There's something I'm missing there?
Representative Ringo.
Well, they're intending 35% of 516.
That's correct.
That's correct. 181.
Sorry.
Okay, they didn't. All right, that's not in the sentence.
Yeah, you're right, it's not.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
Well, this is the frustrating part of this. It begins with, this is a Ways and Means discussion, and I guess you said that somebody had approached you with some suggestions of how to reduce the... I'd be interested in hearing that. I'm not so interested in hearing the argument about whether the fiscal is right, because that's beyond us to be able to gauge. But if there's some helpful information that could reduce the fiscal in any event, I'd be interested in hearing that, I think.
Okay. Representative Lowe?
Thank you. And to that end, I do have a question. How do you justify using the Multnomah County figures, where the population is denser and people more likely in need of services are going to go there, to extrapolate those numbers throughout the whole state? Upon what rationale did you use that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, the reason we use that number is because it was a number that we were able to get, which was a concrete number that was verifiable as to its accuracy. It's the only number that we had to work with. It was the only number that we were able to get in the short period of time that we had. We felt that it was our responsibility to come forward to the committee with whatever numbers that we had that were verifiable, explain where we got those numbers from, and then the committee could determine for itself whether it felt those numbers were valid for all circumstances or not. Otherwise, we would have had to come forward with basically, a best guess. We would have had to guess literally as to what we thought it was. These were the only numbers that we had available in that period of time that we could go to and say, we know for a fact that this number is this, and we know this number is that. And then from that, we did the best we could on extrapolating it. I make no representations or guarantees that number is going to be, 100% accurate statewide. It's the only numbers I could offer you, Representative.
Follow-up questions?
Follow-up.
Well, would it take a long time or be particularly burdensome for you to inquire of the other 35 counties so that we can get accurate numbers?
Well, I'm not aware, Representative Kara, Representative Lowe, I'm not aware of any other county that, except for, I think it is Jackson County, that has a public guardian. So I guess I'm not sure who you're asking me to inquire of, Representative. I mean, we can find out how many guardianships there are throughout the entire state of Oregon by talking to the Judicial Department and having them look in their Oregon Judicial Information Network. But that doesn't mean that all those people who have guardianships are necessarily Medicaid clients. The Multnomah County Public Guardian was able to tell us how many of their guardianships were Medicaid clients. And so that's the problem. I can go out and I can tell you how many guardianships exist throughout the state of Oregon, but I can't tell you how many of those are Medicaid clients.
I wonder whether OMAP or anybody else keeps that data.
I'm not aware of anybody. We could certainly try to find out.
To me that this is an important enough policy decision that we really ought to base it on accurate data.
Certainly.
I'd hate for all those elders to go without protection because we were not willing to go the extra mile to find out the real numbers.
Well, certainly, Representative. I totally agree. I feel it's my responsibility to try to give you the best information that I can. Needless to say, we were kind of dashing. This thing certainly came up a lot quicker than I had anticipated. Of course, I'm kind of green at this. And so we tried to get together as best information we could and get it to you. I would certainly love to have an opportunity to try to get further additional information, which might be helpful in helping the legislature to make an informed and reasonable decision.
Thank you.
Ms. Wright, you were here. Would you come forward? Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You've had an opportunity to hear our free-flowing discussion this morning. Do you have anything you'd like to say?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jennifer Wright. I'm the legislative chair of the elder law section of the bar. And I do think an important, I think Representative Lowe has really hit the nail on the head that we need good data before we decide whether or not this is going to have a sort of fiscal impact that we're talking about. And I think an important point that hasn't been raised is that this is, the figures that SCSD is using here is based on the assumption that every Medicaid recipient who has a guardian has it paid for by the state or would have it paid for by the state. It's an important part of planning when somebody, usually before going on Medicaid, there's a period of time when they have to reduce their assets down to the 2,000 maximum that they're allowed to have. And certainly, a responsible part of that for anyone for whom the need for guardianship is known at that time is paying for the guardianship expenses. I mean, it is outrageous to assert that all of these guardianships are going to be paid for by the state. There's a very small proportion of these guardianships where the need for guardianship comes up after all assets have been exhausted. There's no other remedy. There's no other family member willing to step in and pay. There's no other resource. This figure also includes juveniles. It includes people who aren't in long-term care. This is not a useful number. I really do sincerely sympathize with the representatives from Senior Disabled Services Division. It's true. There isn't a lot of good data out there, and it's very hard to get a hold of it. But this is not good data. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly, then Representative Walker, then Representative Backlund.
I'd just like to know, we have feared two things. One is a fiscal impact statement form that was presented by SDSD to Legislative Fiscal, and then we have the Legislative Fiscal analysis that happens to mirror the numbers from the SDSD form. Did you have any input on a revised fiscal impact statement?
Well, I think that it is, I agree that it is very likely that the availability of a program which is in rule and therefore known to people and accessible will probably increase the numbers. There are probably some people now who struggle by without. We know that. But I think the number that to start from that is the most useful number is the number of people who are already getting this paid for by SDSD, which is 50 people per year.
If I could follow up.
Follow up.
But again, my point is, I guess, were you involved at all in the process in preparing this revised fiscal impact statement?
Mr. Chair and Representative Shetterly, I was not.
Okay. Representative Lowe, or I'm sorry, Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's early still.
Mr. Chair, which Walker?
Cheryl Walker.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The figures that were prepared here were prepared on numbers from Multnomah County, which I would presume they included filing fees that would be counted in such costs, because if they're deducting $200 or taking $200 a month, they're going to have to, according to the testimony we heard the other day, have to take about 2 months just for filing fees, around $400 or more dollars for filing fees. I think that's probably the highest in the state and perhaps as much as double as it is in many other jurisdictions. Those are very high filing fees. And if we're going to apply $400, $400 to $500 filing fees on every district in the state, that is going to inflate the cost considerably, because most counties do not have filing fees that are that high.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in Marion County, the filing fee is $68.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, just to answer that, we went not by the filing fees in Multnomah County. What we did was use the $200 a month figure and extrapolated that out through the entire fiscal year, biennium. So because there is nothing in the legislation that specifically says it's just for the setup fees, it says that it's a $200 a month fee for any, or $200 a month for any of the fees incurred by the guardian.
Representative Walker. Cheryl Walker.
At the hearing the other day, and also again here today, it's my understanding that that fee is only to be taken so long as to pay for the cost of setting up a guardianship. It is not to be applied for the lifetime of the individual. If you have a $1,000 attorney fee and a $100 filing fee, you have $1,100. By the time you take $200 a month to pay that $1,100, you're finished. It's not to continue throughout the year for the lifetime of the individual.
Representative Walker, if I may respond to that, I don't see anything in the statute that creates a termination date for the guardianship. Once the guardianship's created, it's created. It goes on until it's terminated. There's nothing that forces the termination of the guardianship. Presumably, the condition which caused the person to be placed in the guardianship is going to be an ongoing condition in most cases, which means we're going to continue to have ongoing costs of the guardianship. If nothing else, we have to have annual filings with the court. I see nothing in the bill that says that the guardian isn't going to be paid a fee for acting as the guardian. We may have the spouse of somebody who is a protected person being paid by the state for acting as guardian for their own spouse. I respectfully disagree unless I've missed something or overlooked something, but I don't see anything that indicates that it ends at a particular date.
Representative Backlund was...
Mr. Chair, I think my question's been answered.
Okay. Representative Walker, Cheryl Walker, you had a follow-up?
Well, yes, I do. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Backlund. It says here, the medically necessary guardianship expenses, we're talking about medically necessary guardianship expenses. We're not talking about a guardian who is managing all of the finances of an individual and taking care of them on a weekly or daily basis. These medically necessary expenses, maybe the attorney will spend 1 hour a month at the most, or even 30 minutes. I mean, maybe a phone call. Because these medically necessary expenses are not going to be something that's going to be recurring on a weekly or daily basis. Perhaps it might if they become very ill at some point, but the rest of the time it would not be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, Representative Walker is actually knocking at a door of another concern of mine about this legislation, which heretofore hasn't really come up. I'm not exactly sure who has the authority to determine what constitutes a medically necessary guardianship. Is SDSD going to be authorized to promulgate regulations to say, well, this guardianship was created under such and such a circumstances as a medically necessary guardianship, but now it's no longer a medically necessary guardianship, necessarily a guardianship necessary for medically necessary, Peter Piper Pecta, no. The problem is, as I said, once the guardianship is created, until there's a court order terminating the guardianship, it remains in effect. Now, if the court hands down an order creating the guardianship saying this is a medically necessary guardianship, the state of Oregon, SDSD, I presume, is stuck with having to recognize it as a medically necessary guardianship until a court order comes along either terminating the guardianship or a court order comes along saying that this guardianship is no longer medically necessary.
Representative Cheryl Walker.
Thank you. The Amendment 2 that we had at the hearing, it says on there that the legal and guardianship expenses for medically necessary and guardianships means those legal and guardianship expenses that are incurred when a court appoints a guardian in order to access or consent to necessary medical treatment on behalf of the applicant or recipient, including but not limited to guardianship costs, court costs, and attorney fees. So I interpreted that at our hearing to be an adequate definition, and if that's not adequate, then we need to fix it. But I determined that to be an adequate definition as to what medically necessary was, and it's in those instances where a person is not capable of consenting on their own.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, the definition may be fine, but once again, who determines when the guardianship continues to meet that definition? Is it the court? Is it SDSD through administrative rule? If it's not SDSD through administrative rule, then presumably it's by the court. And once again, does SDSD have standing to go into court and challenge whether it is still a medically necessary guardianship? Because these are questions that we could end up, as I said, we could end up once it's created as a medically necessary guardianship, and I would presume, again, if the judge in his order says this is a medically necessary guardianship, it would seem to me that SDSD is stuck with it, even if the circumstances change. And I would imagine that if I was to try to appear in court and challenge this guardianship, my esteemed colleagues in the elder law section would probably try to raise some sort of issue about whether or not SDSD has standing. And I certainly can guarantee you that they would say, well, who are you to be coming in here and interfering in private family business as to whether this is a medically necessary guardianship?
Representative Ringo and then Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you began this discussion with a comment that we all agree with the policy objective, but we needed to get our hands around the cost issue, and Representative Shetterly followed up with a similar comment, and I think we need to go back to that because we're really not getting anywhere. Personally, I'm very skeptical about the figures put forward by SDS, and your explanations just make me more skeptical, but I would like to create a process to try to get to the bottom of what the real figures are and move forward.
Appreciate that, Representative Ringo. Representative Shetterly, it would be my intention. Do you want to say something first?
I would, just if okay. I can. I think I know where you're going, and that's fine with me. But did I understand that your assumption on the fiscal is that you basically calculated this on maxing out the $200 per month per client?
That's correct.
That's insane. That's $2,400 a year for a guardianship. I do tons of guardianships. I've never seen one cost $2,400 in a year when you're talking about an indigent client. That's incredible.
Okay.
I think the numbers need to be worked, but they need to be worked. There's some credible.
Well, here would be the chair's intention would be to close the work session on this bill and hold it. And I would ask Ms. Wright if you would. I was given a copy of a memo which I had only asked for yesterday, and they were very good to get it turned back around and to me this morning. From SDSD about possible alternatives that they think might have a cost savings impact on 2364. I guess I would ask Ms. Wright if you would work with the folks from SDSD. And then I'm going to ask Representative Cheryl Walker and Representative Kathy Lowe if the two of you would involve yourselves in this discussion with the parties that are sitting at the table before us. And I'm going to ask counsel if we could consider to list this bill on next Friday's calendar for the full committee. Representative Ackerman.
I have several questions, Mr. Chair, that I hope will clarify some matters, and my questions are directed to the panel. The way I read the bill, and isn't it correct, that we're really establishing a separate species of guardianship, and that the guardian in this situation is only authorized to access consent to medically necessary treatment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I don't believe that is the case, actually, because this does not amend Chapter 125, which is the guardianship statute, and so it does not. These guardianships are designated as medically necessary for the purposes of the Medicaid rules and statutes, but would not be designated as a different kind of guardianship under Chapter 125.
I'm concerned about the language in Section 1, Sub 2, where it says, obtain a court-appointed guardian in order to access or consent to necessary medical treatment. It seems as if you're limiting the authority of the guardian to that specific act. And what I'm concerned about is, why don't you just amend the guardianship code to include this authority within the other statutory authority that authorizes guardians to act in other cases, such as, being a caretaker for the protective person or handling some financial affairs for the protective person. I'm kind of concerned that we have sort of a separate species here, which is, we could approach it much more easily.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, as the guardianship statute stands now, by law, a guardianship has to be tailored for each individual person. The powers of the guardian are to be defined according to what that person needs. As a general rule, power to make health care decisions is included. It doesn't have to be. Somebody might have an advance directive and need a guardian for other purposes, and that power could be excluded. But as a general rule, that is part of almost every guardianship I've ever seen. But there really isn't a one-size-fits-all guardianship. We're supposed to have it tailored individually from a list of powers that the court can give the guardian.
That doesn't really answer my question as to why this authority isn't generally granted a guardian in the guardianship statutes already.
It is.
It is?
Yes.
Then why are we passing this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, we can get, it's not, the problem is not getting the guardians, it is paying for the guardians. We have authority under state law to set up the guardianships, but there is no one to provide the funds to pay the filing fees.
So you're telling me if I looked at the guardianship code today, I would find a provision in there where a court-appointed guardian, could be court-appointed to access or consent to medically necessary treatment?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Then my other question is, again, to the panel, do you anticipate in these situations that this court-appointed guardian would be handling the financial income of the protected person or paying that person's expenses?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, under Oregon protective proceeding statutes, a guardian can only handle a very minimal amount of funds. If there is any sort of if there's any sort of assets at all to be managed aside from perhaps a small bank account, and if there are any substantial income that is not pretty much entirely going to pay the current needs month by month, a conservator must be appointed to handle that.
Thank you. And then my last question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I haven't had a chance to absorb all the financial details because they just were presented to me this morning. But are you assuming in your statistics that all of these guardianships that you reviewed have no other assets? That is, they're essentially insolvent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I would kind of like to respond to this particular issue. I think there's a common misconception that everybody who receives Medicaid is by necessity impoverished. You know, definitions of impoverishment can certainly vary, but I have... I took on the current position that I have in SDSD in October of this year. Just prior to the holidays, I was keeping track of what we call spousal support orders. What this is a means whereby if we have a husband and wife, and one of these parties, just for the hypothetical purposes, the husband is going to be a Medicaid recipient, what they do is they go into court and they file a petition for spousal support. With that petition, they transfer anywhere upwards of $149,000 worth of assets from the one spouse who's going to be receiving assistance to the spouse who is not going to be receiving assistance. They also, of course, transfer the personal home, which is an exempt asset, for the purposes of determining eligibility. It is not impossible to see a married couple with upwards of $300,000 of assets, and I've even seen cases where they've come forward and tried to transfer as much as $500,000 worth of assets in order to make one of the marital couple eligible for Medicaid. Now, in those sort of circumstances, I have a real concern where we come in and say, well, there's nobody to pay for setting up a guardianship for this one person. And then to turn around and also pay a spouse who has just received $149,000 worth of assets plus the family home, you know, $50, $60, $75 a month, to be guardian for their own spouse, I have some real concerns about, well, the fairness of that.
If I could follow up, because that, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Beck.
Thank you. I think you raised an extremely interesting point, but I don't think you answered my question.
I'm sorry, sir.
My question was, in your statistics in determining the fiscal impact, do we assume that all of these guardianships that you reviewed are insolvent and don't have other funds which could pay for the legal administrative costs of the guardianship?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I the only guardianships that SDSD currently reviews, if you will, is the 50 cases that my esteemed colleague Jennifer Wright was referring to. We do have a program where if somebody has no other person to create the guardianship under extreme circumstances, we will provide the setup fees. Otherwise, we don't review any guardianships. Did I respond to your question, sir?
Excuse me.
No.
Chairman Williams and Representative Ackerman, I think that the simplest answer to your question is yes, we did. We did assume that these individuals would not have other resources and we would be paying for the full cost.
Mr. Chair, I just suggest you can't make that assumption and have these figures hold. There must be some portion of these guardianships that for which the protective persons have other assets. And I'm just suggesting that as your committee works through that, you want to pursue that. I also, you know, believe that you made a good point about the transfer of assets, and perhaps should come back to this committee or other committees with a prospective bill to be able to find some way to set aside those transfers. It's just outrageous that people can avoid this type of financial responsibility in this way.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I think we took this one out and drove it around this morning. Now we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2364, and as I said, the chair would ask Representative Lowe and Representative Walker to work with the three people here at the table. I'd ask SDSD to share your memo that you shared with me this morning with Ms. Wright. This bill will be back on for next Friday, so that gives you a certain deadline in which to try to come up with reasonable alternatives. And I suspect that you're going to want to really give that fiscal a good run through again before you come back. Now we'll open a work session on House Bill 2366. Please, counsel.
Representative Williams, members of the committee, House Bill 2366, carried by Lowe, modifies the definition of financially incapable to allow certain Medicaid applicants and recipients to take advantage of federal supplemental needs trust provisions on the same basis as residents of other states. There is a fiscal impact statement, and I just wanted to make sure everybody has the fiscal impact statement for this one.
Good. Thank you, Representative Lowe.
After all of that, I forgot. I had a little speech prepared, Mr. Chairman, and I'm afraid I'm going to fail you utterly. Let me see. When you file a protective proceeding, you've got to get the court to approve the trust or appoint a conservator to create the trust. But the problem is that there's kind of a catch-22. When you do that, you have to find financial incapacity. Well, as we just discussed rather thoroughly, not everybody has financial incapacity, yet you still need to create the trust. So this bill is going to allow that to happen. God, I hope that's correct.
Okay. Any discussion by committee members?
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative.
I would just point out that what this does is aligns Oregon law with a provision in the federal Medicaid law that permits this to happen that is not available under current state law.
Well, I hate to make it sound like a Ways and Means Committee, but I'm looking at the fiscal. Are we
83,000?
How do we feel about that?
Not good.
Well, it would require an obvious referral to Ways and Means. Do we think it's a good fiscal?
Better than the last?
Well, it's smaller. I'm not sure that means it's better. It's smaller.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Lowe.
I just, of course, it's certainly up to you and the civil subcommittee chairman, the good Representative Walker. I mean, they're both good, but the other Representative Walker.
Clean it up.
Can I have a nap now?
As opposed to
the good one, not the bad one. Huh?
Maybe we should look at this fiscal, too, while we're at it on the other one.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say, the bulk of the additional cost is actually in federal dollars. So if you look at it, just what the general fund will pay for, I believe that this is a worthy enough cause for the Ways and Means Committee to spend some time trying to find that minimal amount of money.
That's an excellent point, Representative Bowman. Appreciate that very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Cheryl Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unlike the one we just had, this one did not have the same discussion in regards to fiscal in the hearing the other day. As a matter of fact, we had a little problem with fiscals the other day. We didn't actually have a copy of one, but we had a number that was estimated to be at about $166,000, as I have in my notes here, and did not know the exact breakdown on it. But the problem that this seeks to resolve, I think, is one that is important enough in regards to dealing with those individuals that kind of fall in the middle there that are going to need this assistance. There are not great numbers of them, but they do definitely have a need to have this kind of a service provided for them in a trust.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shirley.
Thank you. Do you have any indication that there's a subsequent referral on this? In general fund dollars, we are at $34,000 for this biennium, and I don't see anything on here that indicates a subsequent referral, so I think this can go straight to the floor.
Yeah, I was going to say, that my question on this is less than $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that correct? We don't have to
well,
do that?
Well, but I think that's a less than $50,000 all funds limitation. I'm not sure that's a less than $50,000 general
okay.
fund limitation. I have a note here that says, per LFO, must be referred to Ways and Means.
Okay, because our SMS doesn't
I would
show that.
No, on 2366.
Oh, on 2366.
No, that's not what they told me. They didn't.
Oh, okay. You're right. I was looking at the wrong one. Ms. Chartel, do you have swing the mic over to council if you would?
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. Let me just clarify. What happened with 2366 is that LFO provided us with a fiscal statement that said there was no impact. Then during the meeting, a representative from SDSD said, well, I did supply them with some numbers with some sort of impact, so I'm not sure why they're saying there is no impact. I called the analyst on that bill, and she said that she had never received that report. So this new fiscal statement is based on receiving the report. She never said anything about a subsequent referral. That was 2364.
Well, what's the committee's pleasure?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a fiscal statement.
There is in your packet for today. In your today's materials, you'll find a fiscal
today.
Statement.
No, Mr. Chair.
I think our committees are getting geared up before fiscal here.
Yeah, Representative Bowman.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2366 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves House Bill 2366 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, would you call the roll?
Aye.
Representative Backlund. Aye. Representative Lowe. Aye. Representative Ringo. Aye. Representative Sutter. Aye. Representative Cheryl Walker. Aye. Representative Wilson. Aye. Vice Chair Bowman. Aye. Vice Chair Krieger. Aye. Chair Williams. Aye.
House Bill 2366 moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. I'm going to ask Representative Cheryl Walker, the good Cheryl Walker, to carry House Bill 2366 on the floor. If Ben Westland comes and wants to cut out my insides, I'm going to send him to Representative Bowman. That's why I'm going to send him to you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
One of the Representative Walkers is my roommate, and you have just made life miserable for
yep.
me. Thank you.
Yeah. Glad to know that. We'll now open the work session on House Bill 2368. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2368, carried by Ringo, allows judicial review of petitions
concerning advanced directives for health care and petitions related to guardianship to be raised in a single proceeding.
Representative Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very pleased to note that there's no fiscal impact here. And to make our job a little easier, this is designed to remedy the problem where somebody may be filing a petition for a guardianship and at the same time be filing a petition for an advanced directive. The same issues are involved as to the effectiveness of those two, but they can't be handled together. And it's to allow those two proceedings to be handled together so that the issues can be consolidated.
Great. Sounds like a wise technical fix. Are there any other questions for Representative Ringo about this bill? Yeah. Okay. Good. Representative Ringo?
We pass it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Great. Representative Ringo moves House Bill 2368 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Chair Williams.
Yes, we have a amendment.
Yeah, Chair Williams, I just wanted to clarify, Representative Backlund, that was adopted by the amendment
to dash ones.
The recommendation needs to reflect that.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Ringo amends his motion to move House Bill 2368 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, hearing none, would you call the roll?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Bassett?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bowman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Votes aye.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Ringo.
I'm wondering whether we ought to put this bill on the consent calendar.
Oh.
It seems pretty straightforward.
It'll give you something to do, Representative Ringo. House Bill 2368 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Ringo will carry.
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to remind the good Representative Ringo that it's really good to carry an efficiency bill to the floor. That's a good thing.
Glad to get all this advice.
Great. Okay, we'll now open the hearing or the work session on House Bill 2376. Carrier is Representative Bowman.
2366.
No, I'm sorry. 2376.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Juvenile Directors Association, County Juvenile Directors Association. It ends a requirement that the county pays for someone to state office of services to children and families issue dependency actions. It has a fiscal impact, and it has a prior referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
On 2376?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Representative Bowman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill comes from the Criminal Subcommittee on a unanimous vote. This bill is a bill that would delete the requirement, as you had just heard, that the counties pay for the summons. The issue was that counties were being billed for summonses and expenses, that not only did they have no say in determining who is appropriate to summon or to pay expenses for, but they just got a bill that they had to pay. And there was really no good explanation as to why that was. And so this bill will delete that requirement for some counties to pay these fees. The fiscal impact, there will be a fiscal impact in 2001, 2003, and 2003, 2005. General fund, $52,000. Federal funds, $33,000. So this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Representative Bowman? Any discussion by the committee? Representative Bowman.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2376 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman has moved House Bill 2376 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Lowe.
Mr. Chair, I will be giving a courtesy vote yes and reserve my right to think about this a little bit longer when it comes to the floor. It's a question of whose ox gets gored.
Okay, thank you, Representative Lowell. Any other comments or discussion? Any objection to Representative Bowman's motion to move this bill to Ways and Means? Hearing none, House Bill 2376 moves to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. We'll now open a work session on House Bill 2377.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2377 comes to you from the Juvenile Directors Association, County Juvenile Directors Association. It ends the requirement that counties pay for witness fees, mileage costs, and travel expenses of witnesses to state office to children for service and family issues in a dependency action. It has a fiscal impact of approximately $10,000, and it has no prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Council. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the second bill of two that deletes the requirement that counties pay for services that they have no say in determining whether it's an appropriate service or not. There was objection stated, I should say, in the subcommittee, but the objection was that the fiscal was not included in the governor's budget. No one objected to the core policy issue, which is, should you be forced to pay for services that you have no control over, determining whether they are appropriate for that purpose. And so this came out again on a unanimous vote from the criminal subcommittee.
Thank you, Representative Bowman. Any questions of Representative Bowman or discussion by the committee?
Well,
Representative Vicki Walker.
I just had a thought about the last comment that Representative Bowman made. I thought that Kathy LeDesmond did object on a policy standpoint, because your question to her, Mr. Chair, was from a policy standpoint, do you oppose this? And she answered yes. So I'm not sure that your representation was accurate.
Ms. LeDesma is sitting in the audience. Ms. LeDesma, would you nod your head whether or not you object on a policy statement? Ms. LeDesma indicates that they do object on a policy statement on this bill.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Walker.
Okay.
I think we overrode her policy objection.
Right. No, that's
in any event, but
that's right.
We
still moved the bill forward even though they had a policy objection. That's fine. Any discussion?
Same reservation, Mr. Chair.
Same reservation from Representative Lowe. Any other discussion by the committee or any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Backlund.
The committee moved ahead with the policy objection. I must have missed what was that policy objection?
Representative Vicki Walker, do you recall specifically?
Yeah. Representative Walker takes excellent notes, so yeah, I'm trusting that she that she can answer that.
I'm trying to look here who's to pay in the statute and leave it up to the judge to decide. I don't see it off the top of my head. But Ms. LeDesma is here, and she could probably tell us quicker than I know.
Ms. LeDesma, please come forward.
I did quote you correctly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can you identify yourself?
I'm Kathy LeDesma from the State Office for Services to Children and Families. Our policy objection comes from ORS 419A012. That gives the County Juvenile Department Director the responsibility for furnishing, quote, such information and assistance as the court requires.
Representative Backlund, I'm going to see if I can
good.
Get to it. the statute currently does require the County Juvenile Directors to provide such information as the court requires. But oftentimes in these proceedings, it is a proceeding between the State Department and they're working with the court, and the County Juvenile Directors are sort of on the hook to pay these fees even when they're not participating in deciding or having any input in who's getting called as a witness and all those other things. And so they're sort of left holding the checkbook, I think would be their description of this issue, without really being directly involved in the decisions about who does and doesn't get called. And so they would like it simply to be that if it's the state that's doing this, then and the state making the determination of who the witnesses are going to be, that the state pay the fees. I think that's generally, and I'm looking to my county juvenile directors sitting there, they seem to be nodding that I think I've captured the issue
generally. So that's the, it is another whose ox is getting gored, and it really comes down to just a fundamental policy decision of do we want the state to be responsible when they're primarily running the issue. And Ms. Ledesma, I think, would have a differing view of why that ought to be the county juvenile director's still in the loop.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'm glad I could be of assistance.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lowe.
I remembered it exactly the opposite, and so I would be voting yes in my heart. I don't need a courtesy vote.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, I'm glad I could help that.
Oh, good.
Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. The chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move House Bill 2377-6.
77.
To the Ways and Means, no, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves House Bill 2377 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any discussion? Would you call the roll?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bowman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2377 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
That would be me.
Representative Bowman would like to carry that bill, and I would be honored to have her do so. We'll now open the work session on House Bill 2391. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2391 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. Both the original bill and the amendments come from the Law Commission. It comes from the Juvenile Law Task Force of the Oregon Law Commission, which is made up of practitioners from both the Department of Justice, the Criminal Defense Bar, and from agency people like SCF and the courts. The bill has two parts. The bill requires a court, a citizens review board, to ask the parents before the court or board for the parent's current address and telephone number, and the address and telephone number of a person the court or board may contact. And then you have the dash one amendments before you, which the bill requires a parent who believes that financial, health, or other problems will prevent or delay the parent's compliance with an order of court must inform the court of relevant circumstances as soon as possible. The second part of the bill comes from the Burke case. We have Michael Livingston here from the Department of Justice, who was involved in the Oregon Law Commission Juvenile Law Task Force and was also the attorney for the state on the in the Burke matter, in Ray Burke, and I'm sure he could answer any questions if anyone has them concerning the facts of that case.
Great.
And Representative Ackerman is the carrier.
Great. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, the recitation, of course, is correct. The bill attempts to amend certain provisions of the juvenile code, which are particular to termination of parental rights. The first is allows the Citizens Review Board to obtain contact information of the parties, particularly the parents. Although that might be viewed as a housekeeping situation, it does have linkage to the second point in that in termination proceedings, the state has an extremely high burden of proof. It must establish by clear and convincing evidence that the parents not only are unfit, but that the agencies have made reasonable efforts to reunite the family. What typically happens, and there was a case before the Court of Appeals where the parent, although probably unfit, was able to show that the agency did not take reasonable steps to reunite the family and to extend times for him to receive sexual offender types of treatment and things of that nature. The court basically held that the state had to establish that they were able to extend these services. These services were not extended to the father in this case because of just a basic breakdown in communications. So one of the things that this bill attempts to do is to require the parents to maintain contact with the agency, and the Citizens Review Board can provide, can ask for contact information. That information could also be confidential. I think on a more serious note is the second portion of the bill, which actually authorizes the agency to go back into court where there's a dispute with the parent regarding the parent's ability to follow a service agreement. And they can actually require the parents to go through mediation on the service agreement or bring the issue to the court. The purpose on bringing it to the court is that it would give the agency a method to create a record to show that they made reasonable efforts to integrate the family, and also to make an effort to show on the record that perhaps if the parents may not be assisting or cooperating in that process. That would give them a better record to show that they have extended services or attempted to extend services to reunite the family, and would provide a better record to show that parental rights should be terminated if the parents fail to take those steps. Basically, it provides, I think, an opportunity to get a court order to compel the parents to cooperate with the agency.
Great. Thank you, Representative Ackerman. Any questions for Representative Ackerman? Okay. Why don't we, Representative Ackerman, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, I, Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2391 be passed to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
And we had a dash one amendment on that as well.
Okay.
So it would be the bill as we adopted that amendment in subcommittee, as I remember. So it would be the bill as amended.
As amended.
Right. Representative Ackerman has moved that House Bill 2391, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Would you call the roll?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative
Moe? Aye.
Representative Rebo?
Aye.
Representative Chamberlain?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bowman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Both aye. House Bill 2391 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Ackerman, would you carry the bill on the floor?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll now open a work session on House Bill 2410. Ms. Chartel.
Good morning, members of the committee, Chair Williams. House Bill 2410 just extends to people involved in mediation, board members, officers, volunteers. It extends exemption from liability to those people. It also extends slightly what is also exempted, because some of these dispute resolution centers offer other services in addition to mediation. And this passed to the full committee unanimously, and Representative Shetterly is to carry it to the full committee. And thankfully, again this morning, there is no fiscal impact.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Chair. Under current law, we have in the statute a limitation on liability for mediators, mediation programs, and dispute resolution programs. Limitation on liability unless an act or omission was done in bad faith, with malicious intent, etc. Also, the same kind of limitation on liability regarding disclosure of information. This bill extends that limitation on liability to officers and directors as well of mediation programs, so that the directors and officers of mediation programs will enjoy the same limitation on liability that the mediators do. I think in this sense it's probably just closing a gap that would have been inadvertently left by not providing for them in the first place. It's designed, of course, to make it easier to recruit volunteer board members and directors by giving them some degree of protection from civil liability. And it does extend beyond just mediation now to other dispute resolution services, because the world is changing and we have broader dispute resolution services than just mediation. So, good bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Shetterly? Representative Ringo.
Representative Shirley, do those other services that you just referenced include arbitration services?
Let me see. They have to be performed under ORS 36100 to 36.245. No, those are not arbitration services. You have, for instance, if you look at up at the top, this was sponsored at the request of the Polk County Victim Offender Reconciliation Program. That's technically not mediation. That's taking victims of crime and putting them together with the criminal perpetrator, and then through that arranging and negotiating a contract for restitution. That's not mediation, for instance. Yeah.
Okay. Committee?
Oh, Mr. Chair, sir. I was already on my way to the office.
Yeah. Representative Shetterly.
Move House Bill 2410 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2410 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bowman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chair
Williams? Votes aye. House Bill 2410 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Krieger has yet to carry a bill from this committee, so I'm going to choose this one for Representative Krieger to carry.
You don't have to carry my bill.
You don't have it. You are the sponsor. Do you have a problem with that?
No problem at all.
Okay.
If they ask any technical questions, to you.
So I'm going to ask Representative Krieger to carry. Have you carried a bill out of this committee yet, Representative
Walker?
I have
one. You gave me one today.
I gave you one today. Is there anybody else that has yet to carry a bill out of the Judiciary Committee? Or that doesn't have one. I know you carried 2100.
Co-carrier?
Yeah.
We could do co-carriers.
No, I don't. I just want to make sure we're spreading the wealth reasonably good around. With that committee, we'll be done. I do want to just tell you one thing and remind you. It is on the 13th of next week, Tuesday the 13th, that we are scheduled to have lunch with the members of the Supreme Court at the Supreme Court building. So I would encourage you, we sent out a notice quite some time ago about that, but just reconfirm that that's on your calendars. It's our opportunity to have an informal discussion with the members of the Supreme Court, and I encourage you to attend. With that, we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you for your hard work this last week, and we'll see you on Monday, if not sooner.